Hey everybody, Dave Hodges here. I'm the host of the Common Sense Show. We are the show that is freeing America one enslaved mind at a time. And we're going to ask you to please share what we do here far and wide, because we got a lot of people out there right now that are kind of choosing to stay out of the fray, not be knowledgeable, not prepare spiritually, emotionally, physically. And I think we need to nudge them into a position where they need to be at least active in their own lives, in terms of getting ready for what's coming, because we live in a time of tremendous change and upheaval, and you don't want to get caught off guard. So we ask that you share. We're coming to you from the Noble Gold Studio, and I have to tell you, I've been a customer of Noble Gold for 6.5 years. The federal government requires me to tell you that. You know, that's true. I'm happy. I've been advertising for 7.5. I have to tell you that too. And I also have to tell you that no investment's guaranteed and past performance can't be construed with future. Okay. But remember, I've been a customer for 6.5 years. And why am I happy with Noble Gold? Because I got retirements and I don't want the banks to have them, because under the Dodd-Frank law 2010, they can take them. I've been declared to be an unsecured creditor. It's unconstitutional, but it's the law. And Noble Gold can extract your retirement from your bank, back it with precious metals like gold or silver or both, and you'll be in control of it. And gold's held its value for 6,000 years. What can we say about the dollar at this point in time, right? So let me help you with this and with other things. I can send you a free information packet. Simply go to DaveHodgesGold.com. That's DaveHodgesGold.com. I'll send you out an electronic packet. You look at it, give Noble Gold a call, let them know I told you to call. You'll get the royal treatment. DaveHodgesGold.com. Well, for Prophecy Watchers, we've got our friend Mondo Gonzalez, also a friend of my broadcast partner, Doug Thornton. And we're really happy to have him here. And he uses, and Mondo, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but the way I interpret it, you kind of use archaeology to prove the Bible. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely, it provides great evidence and correlation and confirmation of the things we find in scripture. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's, and I think that's so awesome. Everyone says, oh, you can't prove God. You've got to accept it on faith. I agree with the faith part, but God invented science and all the stuff related to it. There's nothing wrong with us going out and saying, we see God here, we see God there. And I'm so glad that you're doing this work, but you've been so active here. And anyway, I want to welcome you to the show. It's an honor to have you back on. I know how busy you are. You just got back from Singapore, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I was in Singapore for about 10 days and then even into Malaysia. And then we got back for a couple of days and I was over in Colorado Springs. And so it's been a whirlwind. And this fall, we're going to be back in Europe. We're going to be in Greece and Turkey and a couple other places. So it's quite a busy time for sure.
What are you trying to accomplish when you go and speak at all these different areas?
You know, that's a great question. Well, there's a couple answers. The main answer is that we what in our audience worldwide, and there's a lot of English speakers around the world, and as they listen, what we find is that 90% of the time, it's happening here in America as well as in Europe, is that these people who are believers, they follow Jesus Christ, and yet their churches will not talk about prophetic events. They will not talk about how the world's going to hell really fast. Globalism is on the in rise, you know, as we see around the world, elections are being stolen in different places. But the churches don't want to talk about it. And so they are eager to learn. And so they invite us to come speak. And so as we have gone into these various places, one of the reasons, I mean, we know that they could just watch on YouTube, but they want more than that. They actually want to feel a sense of encouragement and solidarity. So when we go over there, our goal is to equip them, to encourage them to start a work in their own area and to be like, hey, you know, the most important thing, as you said earlier, as we watch things get crazier, what we know is that what people need most, besides truth, is fellowship and connection and the ability to be with somebody who's like-minded, because we know that the enemy works to isolate us. And
Yes.
of course, as we know through, I mean, it's one of the that's why we had the First Amendment, because if they knew that if they could shut down truth, even in the past, which is what the England did, then you can't, people will not unite against tyranny. And so anyways, that's what we're finding most importantly as we go around the world, is that they want to hear, number one, you know, Bible teaching, but they also just want to come together. And it's nice when you get together and you'll see 700 or 800 people, and they're like, I didn't know there was this many people that thought like I did. And that's exactly the way the enemy works, to try to get people to think they're alone.
Well, Jesus really encouraged fellowship. I mean, the Last Dinner, the Last Supper, so forth. I mean, that's obvious. But, and the Bible says, wherever two or more are gathered in my name, we're made to share the word. There's no question about it. And I'm so glad to see you doing it. How are those governments, particularly like in Singapore, how are they when you go there and profess the word of Jesus Christ? Do you get any opposition?
Well, it's there. Singapore is very, actually has a lot of Muslims in it. And then we went over into Malaysia, which is even more Muslim dominated. But what we found was the first part of the conference that we were at was in Singapore, and the pastor had said, "Hey, look, you can share pretty much whatever you want, but we are being watched by the government. So I would appreciate it if you just showed wisdom." And he actually suggested that I don't talk too much about what was going on in the nation of Israel. So that, because why? This particular part was being broadcast publicly. And so later, when we had our conference, he said, "You can say whatever you want now, because this isn't being publicly broadcast." And that was actually in Malaysia. So that we didn't have any issues there, surprisingly. But again, we weren't publicly speaking about these issues. But it is very true that over there were some restrictions that he they well, I'll say it this way: they control the churches relatively carefully. And so he just said, "Look, I don't want to be on the radar. I have other, more important things to do. I don't want to lose it all just for saying something about, supporting Israel," even though he does, privately. So that it was interesting. It was the first time I ever was kind of speaking in a way under kind of a censorship type situation that could have caused some harm to the local body of Christ there.
Yeah, there's a gr I just looked this up. I had covered this to some degree in the past in America. This came in under Obama, and pastors and churches were paid X amount of dollars to put in a surveillance system with facial recognition into the churches that wanted it, called Church X. Have you ever heard of that?
No.
Yeah, I actually wrote about this during the Obama years. I was shocked. I knew about the clergy response team. That was bad enough. And I actually had someone from the inside, a pastor, Walter Mansfield, actually came to me and said, I think you should cover this. And I agreed with him. But this was something where they're surveilling who's actually going into church. They don't tell you anywhere. This is a DHS project. They don't tell you anywhere what they're using the information for. But, it makes me nervous because history shows that when you surveil a group of people, you're usually preparing to act against those people. At least that's what history shows. And so, yeah, if I'll recall, I'll find the article, I'll send it to you. But
Oh, yeah.
I was stunned. And I don't know if the project's still in effect, but when you said that, hey, we're being watched, that triggered the thought in me about what's happening here. You've had a little resistance from our government, though, in your work and your digs, right? Like the National Archives could care less
Oh.
about what you're doing, even when you can prove something to be true. Am I right?
It is very true. The resistance, especially within the academic world. We've done some great work. We even in Peru with the government. I mean, we're working for the government. They hired us to come in and do some work for them, and yet we do this great work. We provide all this evidence, DNA evidence, and other things. We provide the papers to the archaeologist community, and they just toss it in the back because it did not go along with the conventional paradigm. And then there's hit pieces that you see online, which we don't really care about because our work was very well done. We went above and beyond for contamination as it relates to DNA extraction, etc. But this is just the academic tyranny. I mean, we talk about tyranny in a variety of ways, but even most professors today, they know they cannot go outside the normal conventional ideas, or they'll lose funding. They'll lose status, they'll lose reputation, they won't get promotions. So the idea of searching for truth is very limited today. You go outside of that, forget it.
That's sad. What was the biggest pushback or denial you got from any part of the government or academia? What was the topic area that really concerned them?
The thing that concerned them most was the idea of our research, our DNA research showed that you had transmigration from the Middle East, even Eastern Europe, over to Peru. These indigenous cultures, indigenous peoples, their haplogroups were clearly from the Caucasus regions, the Black Sea area, even Middle East, Eastern Europe, and going back to around the year, 200 AD. And so that's not supposed to be that way. The indigenous people of South America were supposed to only come from the Beringian, theory of the land bridge from Russia to Europe sometime in the previous ice age, where they crossed over and then populated all the Americas. And so what we did find in our studies is that the haplogroup B, it was from Mongolia. It was, from that area, no doubt. Of the 18 skulls that we examined, 58 different samples, types, bone, teeth, hair, etc. Of the 58, well, 18 skulls, 9 of the skulls were haplogroup B. So we reported that. We're like, hey, this is normal. Here it is. But the rest of them clearly somehow came across from the middle part of the world, again, Central Europe, Eastern Europe. And so when they looked at it, they were like, wow, now your stuff was just contaminated. And I was like, well, first of all, it was ancient DNA. It was paleo DNA, where you don't have a lot. We didn't get any nuclear DNA, which is the father's side. But the maternal side, the mitochondrial DNA, there's an abundance of that, and we were able to get some. And that, but even in some of the skulls that we did, there was it was too contaminated, it was too degraded. But the interesting thing about it is we gave our DNA, to the lab. But in fact, if our DNA was mixed in there, we would have had an abundance of nuclear paternal DNA, which wasn't there, which shows you again two reasons: our DNA wasn't found, and secondly, there was no nuclear DNA. So it's interesting that this just goes against the typical paradigm. But I would say most historians recognize that Columbus was not the one who discovered America. Clearly, the Vikings, at least, 1000 AD, had come across, but this goes back even further.
China. Clearly
What's that?
China. Clearly China. I think that's, in fact, they even brag about it. They talk about, if they wanted to, they think this is political now for the CCP, territorial rights over the United States because we were there first. That's something I've read out of CCP propaganda. And I think they're right. I don't think they're right about their land claims, dollar day late and a dollar short, but I do think they're correct that they were here first. In fact, we have found, if I'm not mistaken, coinage from China that predates Columbus by far.
Yeah, there's no doubt that you have a migration across. I think the challenge for them is that there was no migration from Europe and the Middle East until Columbus, and that is just simply not true.
Yeah, I totally agree. In fact, the Vikings, probably the best example of that on that end of things. That's just amazing. You've done something here. Well, before we go there, let me back up here. We talked before when you were on with Doug and I on the Intel report. We had talked about Red Heifer, and I just wondered, where's all this at now with this? And can and maybe bring my audience up to date if they didn't hear that show before, explaining what the significance of this event could be.
It's actually very significant in that the Bible clearly teaches that they're in the future, towards, I believe we're arriving at the end of the age. So whatever that means, I'm not saying it's next week, but arriving towards the end of the age. Israel's become a nation in 1948. They took control of Jerusalem in 1967. And from that point, they began what was known as the Third Temple movement. And so they've been just, the religious Jews have been very committed to creating a situation politically, religiously, etc., geographically, to build a third temple. And so that's been going on a while. They've had ebbs and flows, but the fact of the matter is, right now, they have developed everything they need. It is ready to go. Temple Institute, people can check that out. Temple Mount Faithful, thirdtemple.com. You can see all these different places. But I wrote a book last fall, because a year ago, In September of 2022, the red heifer, there was five red heifers that were flown over to Israel. And so at the time when they arrived, I thought, you know what? This is interesting because the book that I wrote was The Red Heifer Ritual, the last piece of the Third Temple puzzle, because they have everything else ready. But the one thing they need is a red heifer. And in the Bible, in the book of Numbers, chapter 19, it describes a red heifer would be slaughtered. It's not sacrifice. Sacrifices happen on the Temple Mount. This wouldn't happen there. This would happen on the Mount of Olives, just across the Kidron Valley to the east. And so in ancient times, in the Talmudic writings, in the Mishnah as well, it's very clear it happened on the Mount of Olives. So what they need, though, is they need a red heifer in order to burn it, to take the ashes, mix it with water, and then they can use it to cleanse, to purify, is a better word, to purify locations and people, etc. And so this is why they're so determined, these rabbis, because they know we have everything else. The only thing we're lacking is the red heifer. So they've been working on it. They brought five cows from Texas and brought them over, and they need to be 2 years and 1 month old, which that happened last November. So this is the first time in the history of 2,000 years that you have five red cows that are qualified to be slaughtered in this ceremony. Now, since then, two of them have become disqualified, so they have three left. And people need to realize, I mean, this isn't light. They paid $100,000 each for each of them, 500,000, plus another $200,000 to ship them on an American Airlines flight to Israel, which happened. And so here we are. They had talked last summer about doing the ceremony between Passover and the Feast of Shavuot, the Jewish Feast of Shavuot. So basically April 22nd to June 12th of this year. So they had talked about it. Well, then we know October 7th happened with Israel, with the Hamas attack. And then in January, Hamas came out and said publicly that one of the reasons that they attacked the people, you know, that they provided this terrorism, was because of the red cows. So it's interesting that they specifically mentioned the five red cows as a reason. Now, I think it's pure propaganda, but they don't need a reason to kill Jews. But again, they're good at propaganda, so they use that reason. And so, interestingly, you know, in all my interviews and talking to people who were there, who were there when the cows were born, before Hamas came out, they said, "Oh, Mondo, we're on schedule. This is going to happen. You know, April's coming, and there's this window." But then, when Hamas came out, something clicked. And what clicked was in the Israeli government. The Israeli government was very open to the idea prior to this. But then, as you know, as they began to, you know, take revenge and justice on Hamas, they began to receive a lot of pressure from the international pressure, but mostly from the United States government, unfortunately. And so they changed their mind, and they said to the people who were going to be doing this ceremony, "You're not allowed to talk about this publicly. You're not allowed to, we're not providing security for this. So you're no." The answer is no, because they didn't want to be accused of pouring gasoline on the flames, which was already happening. So I do think it will happen. It's postponed for now. We know, again, biblically, that it will in that sense. And so that's kind of the latest update. I also think, too, this is just my speculation. This will be the first time I say it publicly, but I've had several people, friends that have been in Israel in the last few weeks, even in the midst of all the trouble. And they've gone up to Shiloh, you know, where the five cows are being, I wouldn't even say safeguarded, but they're behind a fence. There's one woman there that's kind of the I wouldn't call her the overtaker, but she's the director. And there's another guy who cares for the cows. So they're like, "Mondo, when we go there, there's absolutely zero security. Zero." And so, you know, for these cows, you don't have to kill them. You just have to go up to them and give them a little slice with a razor blade. And, you know, put maybe a brand or brand them. They would be disqualified at that moment. So there's been speculation that the cows that are there in Shiloh that are open to the public are decoys. And which to me, if they're not decoys, then this has got to be one of the most foolish groups, because the security, I mean, they're going, "Well, you're not allowed to pet them." Well, the one guy, he was like, the cow was right on me. It was touching my rear end. I was able to touch it. I got that close, and there was nobody there. So I do think that I don't think they're foolish. You wouldn't be foolish with $500,000 worth of beef and just to leave them out in the middle of nowhere.
That's
But
my thought too. So what are they, why are they being so negligent in security?
well, again, if they are, I cannot give you a real reason. It doesn't make any sense.
I know.
If they're decoys, then they're there for, in order to, for publicity reasons and to raise fun. So, you know, they when you're there, there's opportunities to donate, to the cause, to for their care, et cetera, et cetera. But there's no way that I'm not convinced that they would just leave them open to anybody to be able to come in there and harm them. I mean, again, it doesn't even have to be a death. It just has to be a little nick.
Yeah, that's not the real deal. Is it your suspicion, though, that they do have a red heifer somewhere else that they're guarding securely?
Yes, I do. There's no doubt there were five absolute pure red heifers that came over originally. Those aren't decoys. Those are real. But the ones that are, and I imagine the two that are disqualified now probably are among those five that are at Shiloh. So that's reasonable. Again, I'm thinking out loud here. I'm not making any claims, but it seems very unusual that they would leave them so wide open without being secure. And in fact, when they first came, they had them in a secure, undisclosed location. And then they originally had brought three over to Shiloh to show the public. Again, they were trying to bring the public in to raise money. And then eventually two others showed up, so which makes the five there. But I don't think so. There's no way do I believe that the three that are qualified would be there. No way. They're secured somewhere else, in my opinion.
Well, what's the significance? At some point, the heifer, does it have to be slaughtered?
Yes, what they'll do is they will take it over to the Mount of Olives. They will build a wood pyre, you know, basically a big bonfire, and they will slit the throat, take some of the blood, sprinkle it towards the temple area, just as a ceremony, and then they will burn it, 100% burn it all the way down to ash, and so that'll allow them to use the ash mixed with water for later purification purposes. But I think too that some people have asked me, well, Mono, do you think that they have done it in secret? And you go, and it's like, no way, it's not possible. And the reason why is it has to be done on the Mount of Olives. So they have two pieces of property right there. And if people understand, you know, Jerusalem geography, you know that the Mount of Olives is primarily Arab. So, and everything is so densely populated there that it'd be like having a, you know, like in the, let's say in the middle of St. Louis, just pick a city, pick a big city, and all of a sudden in the middle of a populated area, you have a big bonfire. I mean, smokes can be billowing up to the sky. Fire department's going to be called, police are going to be called. The Arabs are going to already they're all, according to Hamas, they're already aware that they the red heifers. So there's no way they can get away with this secretly. Impossible.
Yeah, that makes what you're saying makes perfect sense to me. Okay, so this is like a rite of passage, though, that leads to what for people watching?
What it does is it if they were able to get this done, then they will be able to purify the Temple Mount area at some point in the future when ultimately what is missing, there's one other piece that's missing, and that is the will, the political will and boldness of the Israeli government. So the government would have to provide the security for the Red Heifer ceremony, and let's say that happened. Well, then, in some sort of future peace agreement or whatever covenant of some kind, which we know there is one in Daniel 9:27, that the government would have to, are they going to blow up the Dome of the Rock? Are they going to remove the Dome of the Rock? Are they going to build a temple just to the north? There's several options. But we know right now that a temple, the building of a temple, even if it was not on the Dome of the Rock, just to the north, the building of a temple would be so catastrophic to negotiations right now that it's highly unlikely the Israeli government would truly have to be behind it. And so it's not just going to happen accidentally. So that's the interesting thing, is that we know, according to the Bible, that at the end there will be a temple there. So the fact that all these preparations are happening show us that we're getting towards the end, because it's going to happen. They weren't talking about this 50 years ago or 100 years ago, at least not in, because Israel wasn't around 100 years ago.
Yeah, then you said we're getting towards the end. Are you talking about leading up to the tribulation period?
Correct.
Yes. And does that signify the beginning of that 7-year period?
When what you see the temple, what we know is this, that the temple is there no later than the middle of part of the tribulation. Is it there for a day? Has it been there for 2 years? We don't know. We just know it's there in the middle, after 3.5 years. And so again, could it be there 10 years before? That would probably be unlikely, but we do know it's there. And so
I'll
the
tell you
fact that they're getting ready to build it is interesting.
where my mind went when you were saying that was it's there halfway. I'm thinking 3.5 years of peace gone, 3.5 years of living hell on earth beginning. Maybe that's what it symbolizes.
For sure. At
Yeah,
least.
I'm just thinking out loud here, but see, I think this is a highly significant event. And I do worry that, Satan will try to counterfeit the event to try to change things for his purpose. He doesn't want this sign to come in because people will go, oh, yeah, this is unfolding like we're told. I guess the Bible is correct. And so that's what I think Satan would try to avoid. Tell me about the Psalm 19 project. What's that about?
The Psalm 19 project really came out of just a love of astronomy, and also they and I the truth of the matter is, there was a lot of people who that would approach our ministry and who were flat earth people, and they were very skeptical of NASA. And I'm like, well, I'm not here to defend NASA by any means. NASA is a godless agency. Okay,
Never,
so
never a straight answer is what NASA
exactly.
stands for, yeah.
So, but one of the things that was interesting is people would make the claim that the pictures that we see of nebulae, of galaxies, of clusters, of stars, were all completely fake and computer generated. And I'm like, I've been into astronomy for 25 years. I'm like, well, that's not true. And so one of the things that we did was we had some supporters that decided to join us and simply to take photographs, real photographs, these aren't computer generated, of the heavens, and to share them with anybody and everybody to show God's handiwork. Psalm 19:1 says, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the skies above show forth his handiwork. And so that's one of the things that we've been doing, psalm19project.com. You can see all of our pictures there. I have them all there for free. High definition, you can take them. And it's just amazing what what I have on there too is you can see a comparison of a Hubble photograph of the Orion Nebula versus one that we took. And I'm like, Hubble is here's $5 to $16 billion, and here is not $5 billion. And you can see that our picture is very equivalent to, at least in this one. It was pretty amazing. So honestly, we're just trying to show off. This is what God did on the first Wednesday of the first week, and said, hey, this is what I did on my Wednesday. What'd you do? I created 2 trillion galaxies, just woo, threw them up there, and they're beautiful. I mean, it's amazing what we can do now at a lay person level. I'm not a professional astronomer. I took astronomy in college, but it's amazing the technology that we have. And this, I'll end it on this, that for all of human history, however long some people think that is, doesn't matter. But all we know is for all of human history, except for the last basically, I would say 200 years or less, this is the first time that we've been able to document these absolutely stunning and beautiful photographs of objects that God has created, billions and billions of them out, not only in our galaxy, but out beyond that, and just stunning. And we do it in a layman's thing, in a layman's observatory. So we have a very nice observatory. It's certainly a university class observatory. We have three different telescopes that we use, to photograph the heavens of different, focal lengths, etc.
Okay.
But it's pretty amazing.
Write myself a note here because I have to ask you this, given the fact that we're talking about the solar system, the galaxies, and so forth. What's your position on wormwood? I don't have
Well,
one myself, so you're going to be re educating me.
so my position is, obviously wormwood is in the Bible, Revelation chapter 8. It's describing some sort of heavenly object that is coming out of the sky down into earth, which causes a certain level of poisoning. The word wormwood means bitter, so it poisons the ecosystem, okay, water, etc. So the question is, and it has come to a head with the published work of Tom Horn, Dr. Tom Horn from Skywatch TV. And so he wrote two books, one called Wormwood and the other one called Messenger. And he describes in his experience that he had a vision of the future where he saw an asteroid type object. I don't think it was really a comet. I think it was an asteroid coming down into the earth, breaking up and spreading out as they often do, and causing a whole bunch of destruction on the earth. And so at the time, he was like, okay, I'm seeing this, and this is his story. I mean, I think highly of Tom, man of integrity. I don't believe he's making this up. So he said this vision that God gave him, then he heard the word Apophis, and he's like, Apophis, what is that? And so then he went, and it's a name of given for the Greek, or not Greek, the Egyptian god of destruction. But it was also given the name of a specific asteroid, 99942, that you could look up, of Apophis, that was discovered in the year 2004. Well, what you find in the trajectories, in the orbital trajectories, that it has a future very close encounter in 2029, as well as 2036 and 2052, etc. So what Tom came to believe was that Apophis was wormwood, and that he said it would, that according to what he was very confident, it's going to hit the earth. And so the connection that he made was that this would happen in 2029. Well, I've interviewed Tom several times, on our television program, and I said to him, when you saw this vision, did God give you the date? And he said, I don't know. He did not give me the date. All he gave me was Apophis is wormwood. And so right now what you have is speculation of whether you have a 2029 date or whether you have a 2036 date. And so according to the official records, people can find this on Wikipedia. How trustworthy is it? I don't know. It's up to them to decide. But what Wikipedia does show is that it comes within basically 20,000 miles of the Earth, which, the moon is at 250,000 miles. So you're talking a tenth of the way. Now, accordingly, the 2036 is farther out, millions of miles away. But it is well known, and even Neil deGrasse Tyson, who, again, no friend of Christianity, I'm just telling you what he said, take it or leave it, I'm not promoting him. He said there's no way that NASA can say with certainty that Apophis, if it comes through the solar system, comes through by the Earth, comes by the Sun, heads back out, and would not have its orbit potentially adjusted, which could then on a 2036 revisit hit the Earth. So he said there's no way. You can't guarantee that. We don't have enough knowledge. We understand Newtonian physics, so I'm not saying that. He says, but we don't have enough knowledge that you couldn't have these other perturbations that happen and change it. So the interesting thing is, we have within, it's 2024, within the next 12 years, we have two instances of where Apophis could absolutely strike the earth.
How big is it? Do we know?
It is about 1,200 feet tall. So, what is that? The Empire State Building?
Yeah.
Huge.
Yeah.
Yep.
I mean, just passing by, let's just say it comes to with 200 miles. you're still going to have terrible disruptions. You'll have tsunamis and earthquakes and just the effect on our gravity. That's incredible. The question I have, though, is I wonder if the spin-off effects are what we read about in the Bible, where bodies of water turn to blood. Do you think that's related?
I don't know if that's specifically related, because that seems I take that judgment actually quite literal, similar to how Moses turned the Nile water into blood. I don't really know how an asteroid could do that. An asteroid certainly could pollute and poison water systems, including the ocean, to some degree. That's very scientifically reasonable.
That was where my mind went on that, yeah.
So I totally in agreement on that. But the later judgment of the water actually turning to blood, where all the fish die, I mean, it's bad. I think that's a little bit more supernatural. But no doubt that wormwood is bad. It comes from outer space, and it's going to kill and pollute and cause a lot of havoc. Is that Apophis? You know, if Tom Horn is correct, which I have no reason to question his integrity. I think once he acknowledged that he didn't know the timing, if I was to lend a guess, this is pure speculation, I'm not a prophet, I tend to think that it'll be a 2036 hit.
Okay,
Just my guess.
that's a mouthful though. I mean,
Isn't
it's
it?
hotly debated, but the more I hear it, you've given a pretty cogent set of circumstances here surrounding this that I can buy into. But there's so much controversy. I've listened to debates about it, and I walk away more confused than when I started. But do I think it's real? Yeah, I do. I just don't know the details. You've done something that really caught my attention. And I want to make sure I get the pronunciation right. Screwtapestudyguide.com. And folks, no, this is perfectly legitimate. It's okay. But and I love the study guide is the key phrase in there. What have you done with this and for what purpose?
Years ago, probably, I became a Christian at 18, so it's been 32 years. And one of the first things that somebody did is they said, "Hey, you should read the Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis." So, I'm like maybe 20, and I read it, and I'm like, "What in the world is this guy talking about?" And so, I mean, there's a basic plot line. There's a guy go, whatever, he's tempted with the devil, and he's got basically it's a fictional book of a junior devil tempting a human patient and getting advice from a senior demon. Okay, so that's the basics, and it follows the different temptations that the senior demon is trying to help the junior demon to tempt this guy on. And so C.S. Lewis writes this in such a way. It's amazing writing. And I think I was too young and dumb at the time to understand. And so later, though, I revisited it roughly around 2008. So I'm about 15 years later, and I thought, you know what? There's a lot of good stuff in here. And I decided I wanted to teach it at the church I was pastoring at. So I went out, and there was a couple study guides, just real little ones. And as you get into it is as deep as you think you can go. I mean, C.S. Lewis was a brilliant thinker. I mean, he studied the classics of Greek, Plato, Homer, Aristotle, in the original Greek, classical Greek, as a 12-year-old. Okay, so he was trained in the classics, and then he became the medieval chair of English literature at Oxford and Cambridge. So no lightweight, for sure. So he writes this book in 1941, and he expects you to know all of the classics and all the English writers, and he writes this way. And so I began to read it. I was like, you know what? Where's the study guide? I need a study guide. So I couldn't find one. So I thought, you know what? If anybody ever wants to study the Screwtape Letters again, I'm going to make sure that they have a study guide and commentary that I answer everything. I take every letter, there's 31 letters, I go phrase by phrase through the entire book as a commentary to say, there's, if you want to know what he's talking about here. And so what I did is it took me like 5 years, and I went and I connected all of his other writings. When he, if he brought up a topic, in a very nugget form in 1941 that he wrote on in 1948. I'm like, hey, we know what he's talking about in 1941 because in 1948 he expanded on it, and he goes back and this is what he's referring to. So I cross-reference all of it, all of his other writings. I provide all that in the study guide and commentary. I also make it to where people can study it on their own, small groups, schools, class schools, college classrooms, etc. Really, really easy. But I really think that will always be my most thorough book. I quoted over 1,000 different Bible verses in there showing the theology of Screwtape, and it's actually 200,000 words. So it's two dissertations, two PhD dissertations worth. It'll probably be the longest thing I ever write in my life, but I did it, and people now use it for their small groups. And from what I can tell, people are going, wow, I can understand C.S. Lewis's book now and all of its depth because of the work that was done. So that's the short synopsis.
That's amazing here. What do you think the takeaway will be? Someone goes through your course and they walk away from it. What do you think they take with them typically?
I think what they take away, first and foremost, which is pretty obvious, is that C.S. Lewis was absolutely brilliant. Was he right in everything he did? No, of course not. Nobody has 100% correct theology. And in the book, I describe in those areas where I disagree with him. But nevertheless, he was a brilliant writer. He was a brilliant thinker. He took the razor sharp intellect that he had, and he looked at a topic, especially within human relationships, and he said, hey, why do we do this? Why do we do this? Why do I act that way? And how is this a temptation? And how could I be better? How can I respond to it? How can I understand how the enemy's tripping me up in our daily relationships, with family, with coworkers, with people at church, you name it, our own temptations of pride and humility, etc. So what people will walk away with if they are willing to get into it is, number one, C.S. Lewis was brilliant, but also, wow, we are extremely complicated beings. We're made in God's image. The ability that we know psychologically to have all of these things in our past, in our future, these present weights, why and how we think the way we do, how our past, nature versus nurture, they're going to walk away, number one, understanding themselves better, understanding their relationships better, and certainly understanding their relationship with God and what God expects of us.
Oh, that's a mouthful here. How widespread has it gone? Is it generally accepted, or is it narrow specifically to where you've been?
In the sense of the Screwtape Letters,
Distribution, yeah.
like of my book or C.S. Lewis's book,
Your work.
mine has been primarily available on Amazon, and so there, I wouldn't say that because even though I have a master's degree, basically in theology and archaeology and stuff, because I don't have a PhD in English literature, I think that my work has been relatively ignored. But I will just say this, there's nothing else out there like what I've done. Nothing, zero. I mean, all of, and the reason why I think is because most of the C.S. Lewis scholars, English literature scholars, it would take them a lot of time to do what I did. And I don't know why they haven't taken the time. It has never been done. But what I did too, and I didn't write it for a PhD. I wrote it for the average person. But what I did do is I chased it down. And so if any PhD wants to look at it, they can. I'm happy for them to scrutinize it. I chased down every idea that he did, and I provided the link to where he wrote about it. And so it is a treasure trove of information of the different things that he wrote about in there. But will it ever be accepted amongst that world of Oxford? No, probably not, because especially because I'm very conservative in my thinking, and I brought a lot of scripture in there, and so I don't think it'll be accepted for a lot of reasons.
That's why I asked the question.
Yep.
You just built the fence around the question, the purpose of the question I asked. That was very good. Because I think it's fascinating stuff. I want to go to something just general and just get your opinion. And I don't think any of us know for sure, because if we knew, we'd be violating the biblical premise that we don't know the hour of the day when Jesus returns. But when you look at the world today, okay, let me give you my bias first. My bias is that we can reach enough people to repent, have a revival, God will place his blessing back on our nation, and we can push off some of the bad things that could be coming to a much later time. I'm not optimistic in that. That's what I hope for, though. But when we look at when tribulation starts, that countdown, what kinds of things, if any, that you see today say that we're really close?
Oh yeah, I think what we saw in 2020 really was, I think, the beginning, the strong beginning of the end, so to speak. Again, I'm not a prophet, like you said. I don't know exactly the day or the hour. But what shocked me most was that what we know is that according to Revelation 13, we know that the world is going to go towards globalism. There is a new order that's going to happen, where you have a unity of all nations, where there's such a system that's in place that when the time arrives for the Antichrist to show up, which is a specific time, the system will already be in place. He just becomes crowned and then begins to ride the beast, so to speak, the beast system. So one of the things that is a hindrance, an impediment to that, is the United States of America. Because we are so powerful, even though we're declining, we are still one of the, a superpower by many factors. We also have freedom enshrined in the Bill of Rights, the Constitution, and that is absolutely a hindrance, again, to having tyranny. It's amazing the beauty of the Bill of Rights against the tyranny of the English government, and how amazing and far-reaching, prophetically, so to speak, in some ways, that they saw this. And so when you see, but when I go, I'll say it this way, when I go back to 2020, I just simply make a comparison between the generation of 2020 and the generation of 1776. And in 1776, the mantra of Patrick Henry, give me liberty or give me death, right? I mean, we know that. We learned that. Well, many times they don't learn that anymore in the history classes. But historically, these people, this generation, they valued liberty over death. Now, what we saw in 2020 was the opposite. They're like, the last thing I want is death. You can have all of my liberties. Give me the vaccine. Make me sit down. Keep me in my room. Lock me up. Make me wear a mask. Anything but death. And oh, a few liberties. Here you go. And that shocked me. I thought, well, this is not the America that we learn about in history. And so to see that happen, and then to see the way that people capitulated, even those sadly in the church, I was a pastor at the time, so I saw it. Not everybody, not everybody. There was certainly, I want to say that. And since then, to see the way that this was one of the first times in the history of the modern age where you have globalism dictating to sovereign countries. In addition, I've done a lot of work on this lately too. You think about who was guiding and directing government. Well, it was private individuals like Bill Gates and others who were, I mean, he's not a immunologist, he's not a virologist, he's a computer programmer. But yet here's a guy that was dictating to governments around the world, counsel, giving consultations, etc. So to see all this happen, I look and I go, okay, we are now on the fast track. And what we know, certainly, I'll say it out loud, I certainly believe that 2020 was stolen. I have no problem with that at all. I'm very concerned. I think 2022 was manipulated as well. The midterms, there was a red wave that was beyond reckoning, and it ended up being a trickle. Well, how did that happen? Now, the red wave is real. And so in the same way as we approach 2024, we're going to see, look what just happened in France. I mean, you see all these things happening there. So as we see all these things, what we know is over the last few years that the globalist elite, those that are out for this, they are not sitting on their hands. They have been absolutely busy. We see the riots and other things throughout the past few years being funded No doubt it's been proven by George Soros and his organizations. I mean, they all have the same tents. It's like they're all across. They all have the same colors. So as we see these things, the immorality just from 2015 on, if we think about the LGBTQ, the whole gender confusion, you look at all of these things, you're like, what in the world was released? And here we are.
There's one of the things that I feel, and I've talked to friends and family about this, just my feeling tone, the universe I occupy, there's a change spiritually that's undeniable. There's a if you put your faith in God, you're going to be okay, but there's still an accompanying apprehension that things are changing for the worse. And it almost seems to be momentum driven, and I don't see how we turn it back. Do you think it's possible that repentance and revival could come to America and we could turn it back?
Not all things are possible. So that's not a cop-out answer. That's a real answer, very clearly.
It's mine too, but when you look at it through your logical eyes, and God's supernatural, why we're natural. So I understand the limitation. But as you look at the world, is there any turning this back?
From a part from a miracle, there I don't think so. I think that we are past the point of no return, and there's a couple reasons why. I think that we there's no doubt that we could have pockets of revival in certain areas, around the country. But what we're seeing is an exact duplicate of what happened in ancient Israel, in the ancient, southern kingdom of Judah and how it all came down. I mean, if you read the book of Jeremiah or Ezekiel, where you would be reading the problems that you had there are the problems that we see in our culture in the West. Certainly Europe has been post-Christian for a long time, decades. And so when we think about America as really the last bastion, at least of so-called Christians, 60 to 80% at least claim theism to some degree, and that's getting smaller all the time. But even of that, what we see as it relates to the so-called professed Christians and the way they live their life is no different than a secular person. And so when I look out and I see all of these things happening, I see the church in general failing. It's not preaching truth. It's scared. It's woke. It's becoming critical race theory in their teachings. All the subtleties through the seminaries. All the major denominations have gone way liberal. They're pro-abortion. I mean, they're up there. They're asking for God's blessing on abortion clinics. You think, whoa. So when I stand back and I look at the state of the church, which the church is supposed to be the salt and light, and Jesus said, if the salt loses its basically properties, its flavor, then it's what is it good for? It's going to be tossed out. And so the fact that in general, again, there's always good pockets of churches. I'm not saying that. But in general, the church has lost its ability to influence. And so because of that, I think the only hope for anything is the true church of Jesus Christ preaching the gospel message, because that's how things happen. So if the church is not doing that, then it's over. Secondly, I would say this, that in Romans chapter 1, we see that he says in verse 18 that the wrath of God is revealed against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth and unrighteousness. And it goes on exchanging the creation for the creator, etc. But then in chapter 1, he goes on to say, when you see that level of rejection of God, three times, verse 24, 26, 28, really easy to remember. Three times it says that God abandoned that culture. And one of the evidences that God has already abandoned the culture which abandoned him, they abandoned him first, is sexual confusion, homosexuality, gender confusion. So the fact that we see drag queens in libraries and in schools, the fact that we see all of the confusion with the young people now, and again, we see parents being shut out of surgeries and even knowing these things. So the fact that we saw this explosion really begin in 2015 when marriage, but just as, I mean, 2015, that when marriage was legalized by the Supreme Court, the fact that we see that now, it's not like, oh, wow, God's going to judge us. No, when you see that, it shows that God has already abandoned. This is one of the evidences that God has already abandoned that culture. So when you ask, at least from a biblical perspective, Can the culture be redeemed? I think God is showing already that he's abandoned it. So we are past the point of no return as a culture.
I agree. What I was hoping to hear was the story of Nineveh, and it's possible, but I can't agree with you more. When a nation embraces cutting kids' genitals off and telling 6-year-olds you don't know if you're Tammy or Tommy, that is satanic as satanic can be, and you're messing with the divine order of the Lord. And I can't believe that we haven't put our foot down as a culture, and we deserve judgment because of that. I agree. How do people follow your good work, Mondo? This has been fascinating.
Prophecywatchers.com. If you go there and look where to watch, we are all over television. We're all of us all over social media. We have a monthly print magazine, digital and print, and you can find us there in all the different venues. God has really given us a great opportunity to go around the world on television as well, which we're reaching again. I didn't know this, but the first language of Singapore is English, and even Malaysia. So I was like, really? So, I mean, they all spoke. So the word English has been amazing in that God has allowed us to go into all these places,
Yeah.
South Africa, of course, Australia, and other places as
Or the
well.
Tower of Babel is making a comeback.
Agreed. Yep. Yep.
Hey, I'm saying that tongue in cheek, hopefully. But Mondo, it's been a privilege and honor to have you on. Thank you for what you do. And I look forward to talking to you again.
Amen, bro. Appreciate it.
Thank you.